Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. Now we can do an official welcome on behalf of Torah Motion and Amatai, our co-sponsors for this year's, you know, conference. I want to welcome everybody. It's really been four long years. You know, it's hard to imagine since we've come together to do a live conference, and there is something special about coming. We've done, you know, over 1,500 classes on Zoom in the last few years, but it's not quite the same. And thank you. Thank you. I know many of you. People tell me they see me on Zoom, but I see black boxes usually, you know, but okay, that's the way it goes. Baruch Hashem, people like to, you know, be quiet. And really, I want to welcome, and I think it's appropriate that this conference is taking place as we enter into Yom Yerushalayim, the holiday of the unity. We celebrate the unity of Yerushalayim, hopefully of the Jewish people, to come together and Rosh Chodesh, Kabbalat HaTorah, B'lei B'chad Ki'ish Echad. So it's really wonderful to see people from who I haven't seen in 4 years and longer, and some new people I haven't seen. I want to welcome who came from Australia and this conference. I'm not making this up. You want to raise your hands, rabbis? I think they're eating still. They just, oh, here you are, from Melbourne and from Israel. And I want to give Sydney. I'm sorry, I've never been down under. Okay, so I apologize for that. And from Israel, I want to make a special welcome. Rochelle Turetsky is here from Israel, and we miss her husband, her late husband, but really it's a pleasure to welcome you back. I don't even see where you are exactly, but there you are. And we should have many happy occasions for all of us to come together and celebrate. And really, I want to thank the people on the Torah Motion side. First and foremost, of course, Ilana, who does so much work behind the scenes. For Rachel and Anessa, who's here, was upstairs at the checking you in. And I just want to, there's a lot of work that goes into all of this. And I want to thank all the people who help out. And Achman Chabib, I guess, when we come to medical ethics, of course, is Dr. Laser. He was the one who pushed to make this, do it live. And of course, he's the one year in and year out for 14 years. Designed the program, spoken to the speakers, organized all the topics. So I really want to give him a special yashar koach and invite him to say, introduce our speaker. Bakasha, Dr. Laser.
All right. Thank you very much, Jay. I want to echo the same sentiments, of course, that it's a pleasure to be here in person after several years of a little bit of a lapse. So really, kol hakavod to everybody for coming out. For some of you, it's a very short room.
For this will be somewhere in the States, somewhere in Australia. For sure. We started looking at different ideas. There's a lot of engineering that we wanted to focus on. For example, there's a new COVID for the issue of mental health. Be discussing many other areas in medical alumni. If you wonder about the world class speakers that we have, again, I will introduce each one individually, but you know, you have Baruch Hashem with us, you know, really the authors of the textbook, we have the authors of the farm that we use, day in and day out, we have people that we listen to shiur and lectures from. The last fresh from the beginning. It's really a pleasure also to bring on new faces as well. Yeah, to talk about Brody, the conversation that we've been here, so Debbie Ackerman. Really wonderful type of topic.
If I may, just want to just point out just an idea and a thought as we go into our weekend. We all know that there are no coincidences in life, and sometimes one has to just look around, at, as they say, at the Parsha. And this conference this week falls on Parsha's Bamidbar, and the opening of Bamidbar, as we know, is the Sefer of Bamidbar as well. So I was just intrigued by a thought from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, in keeping with many of the Hasidic ideas, about the names of the Sfarim. And we know that in the names of the Sfarim that we have, if we just do a translation, they're generally speaking incorrect. Maybe we would say that Genesis is in fact Bereshis. That may be equivalent. But once you get to Shemos, Shemos is translated as Exodus. We know that that's not the case. And Vayikra and Leviticus, and certainly when it comes to Bamidbar. So the question really is, the translations are not important because we didn't make those translations. But what is the idea of these? And and it's a beautiful thought in that there is a progression in the Sfarim and the names of the Sfarim that begin with essentially Sefer Bamidbar, with Sefer Bereshis, which essentially, as we know, it's the story of the Kodesh Baruch Hu essentially creating a majestic kingdom, and Avraham Avinu and the children that follow it and basically understand what this purpose of life is going to be. Moving on to Shemos, we have the understanding and the concept that we have individuals, that Eilo Shemos Haboyim Bitzrayim, we have individuals, but by the time they leave Shemos, we end up with a unity, we end up with a Klal Yisrael that goes into Vayikra. What's the purpose of Vayikra? It's not Leviticus, it's Hashem calls out. What does Hashem call out for us to do? Hashem is calling out for us to be able to recognize Kedusha and to separate from Kedusha from Tuma and Tahara. That's what the focus of Sefer of Vayikra is. And finally, we come to Sefer Bamidbar. So Sefer Bamidbar in English is translated as numbers. However, again, the simple translation is Bamidbar in the Midbar. Hashem expects us as members of the human race, and Klal Yisrael in particular, to take this Midbar and to transform it into something of an olam, of a world, something that is a functional entity that a Kodesh Baruch Hu, that we become partners with a Kodesh Baruch Hu. We, everyone, whatever the field is. And that's the backdrop of this Shabbos. The backdrop of this Shabbos is that we are coming together to hear from Rabbanim, from Poskim, from experts, medical experts, and together we synthesize technology. We are going to be hearing about the wonders of the beginning of life. We're going to see how we're going to be able to use technology at the end of life. And we're going to bridge all of these different gaps. And all of these are in keeping with one theme together. We follow the guidance of our Rabbanim and our Poskim. We use the Torah as our map to move forward. And this is how we transform the Midbar, the desert, ultimately into an oasis. That is really the purpose of Klal Yisrael and all of humanity, is to be partners, as we say, Asher Bar Lakim La'asos, that Hashem, that we are partners with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. So it's really a great pleasure to be here together, spending Shabbos together, hearing and trying to make that part of the world a little bit better, into that oasis. To begin our program this evening, it really gives me a tremendous pleasure, a schus, and an honor to once again call upon our first speaker, which will be Rabbi Avraham Steinberg. I've had the pleasure, as we know, he's been our guest here at our conference for 14 consecutive years. We do count the ones on Zoom, so if anybody is being technical and petty, but Baruch Hashem, it's been a pleasure. I probably can recite this by heart, but if I did, I would leave out, many of the different, of the really the wonderful accolades. But I want to just summarize, because in terms of Rabbi Steinberg, for those that don't know you, that don't know Rabbi Steinberg, he is now he's the head of the editorial board of the Talmudic Encyclopedia. He's the director of the Yad Avram Herzog. Clinically, he is a pediatric neurologist with a career at Shaarei Tzedek, still working in this. He is probably most famous because most of us around this room, knowing many of the people that I look around, have turned to his Sfarim, the Encyclopedia of Jewish Medical Ethics, and translated into English by Fred Rosner, his newest volume, the Refuah Kahalacha, this is our go-to svarim. So this is what we use on a continuous and a regular basis. In Israel, he is chairman of more committees at the Knesset that one can think of. But you know, again, he deals with the Moilim and makes sure that the committees for the Moilim are in order. He is the author of many of the Dying Patients Acts. So many different things. The world that Rabbi Steinberg bridges is incredible in terms of how he's able to deal with, you know, on one hand, he deals with a crowd that is in the, providing us the Talmudic encyclopedia. And on the other hand, to deal with a Knesset and just seeing what's going on in Israel these days, just the thought of that is already enough to make one wonder how you can do that. And on the side, he goes to visit the Pope every now and then, to be able to. So really a tremendous, and a privilege and a pleasure, Rabbi Avram Steinberg. It's here. One second, I think they're going to put it up.
Okay, but by the time we'll fix it, the eulogies become longer and longer, unfortunately. It's really a tremendous chus to be here at the Yad HaChazakah, the 14th conference. I think it's the longest lasting medical halacha conference that I'm aware of. It used to be in California, in San Francisco. It lasted 10 years, some were 5-6 years. Now Chemed is starting. Hopefully they'll get to the same number and maybe more, but really this is, I think, the longest lasting, and Baruch Hashem, many familiar faces coming time and again, which proves that it is important. It gives some strength and knowledge for all of us who are in need of this field. So Yishar Koach to the people who do it, to Rabbi Kelman and his wife, to Dr. Friedman and his wife, to the staff and everyone that really is involved in doing this wonderful conference. So thank you, all of you. I am here on this lecture is actually a replacement of someone who has done it for many, many years, probably much better than I can do it, Dr. Eddie Reichman. I don't know why he didn't make it, but they made me his replacement. So I'll try a little bit different way than he used to do, although he did it excellently. So we are talking about challenging ethical problems in the past year. I don't know if it will be exactly the year or a little more or less, but I chose a few topics and you'll tell me when I stop, because I can go on and on. The issues were very interesting. Which one is moving?
Can you advance the slide?
It's easier if I can do it. It will save time. So which one is moving? He is moving? Okay, let's start. So the first topic I want to tell about is the story of the Yemenite, the deceased children. And the story is, okay, everyone saw it, everyone witnessed that. Okay. So the story of the what's called the Yemenite children, although they were not only Yemenite, there were other nationalities. In the early 50s in Israel, there was a terrible weather and the conditions were very poor. Those Olim Chadashim lived in tents and in very poor conditions. And many of their children became sick, were admitted to hospitals, and the parents never saw them again. And it's roughly around 300 such infants who supposedly, according to the health authorities, died of pneumonia or of some other infectious disease. And the authorities told the parents that they were buried in several cemeteries. The parents never saw them while alive, never saw them when they died, and never saw their burial. And they were only notified post factum that this is what happened. Those parents and their families did not believe to this story. They thought and claimed that these children were taken for adoption. And remember, was very close to the Holocaust. There were many sterile couples who couldn't have children of their own. Some made it okay financially. And supposedly it was for the benefit of those children that they'll be raised in a family that has means. And they'll be their children who themselves couldn't have children. And that was their theory of what happened. There were several official investigating committees who couldn't reach a final conclusion whether indeed the babies died legitimately and were buried legitimately or just disappeared. In 1918, a suggestion for legislation was proposed. One of the members of Knesset herself, a sister of one of the Yemenite children, she wanted, since now there are the advantages of DNA, to go to the burial sites to take out a skeleton or whatever was left. That's 50, 60 years later, and they were infants. No one knew what will be found. But if a bone will be found or a tooth, they can extract DNA, compare it to the family, and verify whether indeed this is their baby. That presented, next please. No, next. You need to give me a few more minutes. That presented some difficult halachic shailas, because if indeed the babies were buried there, so the procedure would be to open the grave, take parts of the dead, which probably will be only bones if at all, and transferring the skeleton or whatever bones are found to a special lab that knows how to extract DNA. And all these three manipulations have the prohibition of Cherdat Adin and Nivul Amet, and Nivul Amet is even the Oraisa, and therefore it poses a question. Secondly, those parts of the bone that will be taken to extract the DNA will obviously not be buried again. And if they are not buried, then there is a bitul of Kevura. There were also some technical problems. There are many, but I'll just explain two of them. One is that in those days, they didn't bury the way even in Israel they bury. Here in America, people are buried in caskets, so that you can take out the casket and look if there are bones. In Israel, people are buried straight in the earth without a casket, but they are buried in a grave that is surrounded by stone and covered with a stone so that it can be preserved. In those days, they just made a little hole in the earth, put the body in, cover the body, and that was the burial. Now, it turned out that if a sign was put above such a baby that was buried, and it says, let's say, Leah, with time, the earth moved, and with it moved the body. So what is under Leah could be Moshe from the next grave that moved in here, and Leah actually is in a different grave already. And also, several, if not many, were buried together. If they died at the same time, they made one hole and they put several bodies there. So how do you know which skeleton belongs to who, even if there is a sign? So that's a technical problem, both that it moves or that there are more than one. Next, this member of Knesset, before proposing the legislation, came to the chief rabbis and asked to discuss the matter from a halachic point of view, and if it's okay, she'll proceed with the legislation. In the chief rabbinate, there is a special committee which is called the Vada Lichvod Amet, and I have the honor to be a member, and this came before our committee, and I was asked by the members to write the draft of the responsa, and what we found out was that indeed opening a grave and taking out parts of the dead per se is a nivul amet and has herdas adin. However, if it is done for a purpose which is either significant to the dead himself or for someone else that the dead would be interested in helping by opening the grave and taking him out, then there is no herdat adin or nivul amet. And in the halachic sources, there are several examples, one of which is, let's say, there is a new road being built there and they want to cover the grave, so no one will find the grave anymore. So it's permissible to take out the remains and move them to another place so that the road will not disturb. Or if a spouse, if a woman is left after her husband died and we are not sure if this was her husband or not, so she's an aguna, because until we know for sure that he died, she can't remarry. So it's permissible to take out the remains and check if he is indeed her husband and free her from the aguna. And there are many similar examples. And our feeling was, and later we found that there were some tshuvas about it as well, that to identify the dead and making sure that he is he, whoever is buried there, and to put up a proper matzeva, and to say Kaddish after him, and to come and visit him, these are important things for the covet, for the honor of the dead, which overrides the Nivul Amet by trying to find this out. So therefore, our decision was that that would be permissible for this purpose. And later we found that the handwritten tshuva by Avadi Yosef came up with the same conclusions. As to the DNA, we discussed it with the anthropologist who was supposed to do the digging and the testing. He needed only 2 grams of a bone in order to extract the DNA. 2 grams of a bone is less than a kezayit, and less a kezayit is not mechuyav for burial. So therefore, even if we'll take out the skeleton, we'll take out 2 grams from the bone, and we'll return the rest of the skeleton without these 2 grams. These 2 grams are not mechuyav bekvura because they are less than a kezayis. So based on the heter that we published, there was a legislation done, and now by law, there needs to be a court order, and there are a lot of details on it. It doesn't matter at the moment, but it can be done. And what happened indeed, next please. What happened indeed, that there are currently 2 cases that have been already done according or are in a process of being done according to this law. Case number 1, they opened the grave and they found almost the entire skeleton under the sign which said, let's say, Leah. We're not sure that this was the real Leah, but a full skeleton was found. Remember, it's an infant around 1 year old after 70 years, buried in a very superficial level of earth, and the full skeleton was found. They took the skeleton to Machon Abu Kabir, where they have a special lab. They took a small piece from the skull, and they were able to extract the DNA. There was later a debate, why take out the whole skeleton if you can take only a small piece from the bone? But the reason was it was the first time done, and they didn't know if they can extract really from such a small amount the DNA. From now on, probably, they will not need to take the whole skeleton out. And this baby, if it was the baby under the name that was there, his mother was still alive, 90 some old year, totally demented, and we needed a DNA sample from her, but she couldn't consent because she was totally demented. So it went to the courts to get a court order to allow to take a sample for the DNA, and it was found a full match. This was after 70 years, the baby of this mother, of this family, that indeed died in the 50s and was buried as the health authorities said. Following this case, next one, they went to another cemetery and they opened another grave. But what they found there was that under the name where they exposed the grave was most of a skeleton. But adjacent to it was part of another skeleton. Now, who is the right skeleton for the family who wants the identification? And not only this, but in the surrounding of this grave were six other graves. So in total, there were eight skeletons around this sign that said, this is Leah or this is Moshe. But directly under the sign was a skeleton and part of another skeleton. So they didn't proceed with doing it because according to the legislation, if more than one skeleton is found in one grave, you need the consent of all the partners of this grave, because maybe a certain family doesn't want it, and you can't take out from the grave a part of someone who doesn't want to do it. So the family that was interested, and the majority of the skeleton was supposedly belonging to this family, they said, we don't care about the others. We give consent to do this, and since this is the majority of the skeleton under the sign, this is the one that you should test. If it will turn out that it doesn't belong to us, then test the other one who is only partially. And if this one works, test the other. That we thought was inappropriate. There was in the committee a minority-majority opinion, and I'll disclose to you, I was the minority opinion that said that at least you need a consent from the other one that you exposed. You already exposed it. You have to find the parent, supposedly parent of this skeleton, and get the consent. My other colleagues disagreed with me and said, we don't need to ask consent from the others. This is the family that asks. Let's give it. And the idea behind their opinion was that we need time to find out who is the other parent, where does he live. Until we'll get their consent, this family is suffering. They already made up their mind and they won't. But on the other hand, if this won't be their skeleton, we are taking from a family that we don't know if they agree. So it went to the court because we weren't unanimous. And the court agreed with me. It doesn't mean that I was right. just that the court thought that this was the right way, and now it's pending to find the other one, the other family, and if the other family will consent, either both will be checked against both families, or only one, whoever will want it, and it will be interesting to see if the second case it works well as the first one. So that was one issue that happened recently. Next. Another issue that was discussed in the previous Knesset, and the previous Knesset, you know, is every 2 weeks there's another Knesset. So that was one of the previous ones. There was a debate, there is ongoing debate in Israeli society, especially regarding single soldiers who die. And as you know, we can obtain semen after death. Within 36, 48, maybe even 72 hours after death, there are ways to obtain the semen from the deceased. Thank you. Okay. There are two techniques to do it. One is to stimulate the area electrically, and that produces the semen. And the other one is to do a testicular biopsy and take look for semen in the testicle. And the question that came up is, are we allowed to obtain semen from soldiers who did such a great mission? They died for the sake of us, and we should do something that is possible to give them zecher after death. Next one. So a proposal to the Knesset came up that there should be a law that allows either electric stimulation or testicular biopsy within the limits that it's still possible. And the debate was, should it be only for soldiers or for any person who dies? And maybe he would have wanted children. Why soldiers more than non-soldiers? And what I argued in the Knesset was that when you say soldier, who do you mean? It can be a combat soldier who really fought for us and died. But if it is a soldier that has uniform, but he sits in an office and he distributes salaries to the soldiers, how is it different than a bank clerk that sits in the bank and distributes salaries to people? Why a soldier, just because he has a uniform, should be distinguished differently? And the final proposal, it didn't pass yet, but the final proposal was really that we are not talking only about soldiers, we're talking about anyone that can be obtained semen from him, and he can have a child after he died. The other issue was, should it be a married person who didn't have children yet, or can it be a single person that certainly doesn't have yet children? And the idea behind it is, how do we know that this person would like this procedure? If he is single, he didn't think about having a family at this stage, and maybe he just doesn't, he is not interested, he wouldn't be interested. If he's married, the mere fact that he married is a sign, is a chazokah, that he would like to have a family, have a offspring, and therefore that would make it easier. So married has an advantage over single, but is single excluded totally? We'll come to it in a minute. If he is married, so can the spouse veto the whole process and say, I personally don't want to be inseminated with a semen after death? Let's say I want to remarry, I don't want to have the burden of having a child from our previous husband. I loved him, everything was fine, but that's a burden that is not necessary. Or do we need only her consent or non-consent, but she doesn't have the power of veto? But if he is not married or the spouse is not interested, can the parents request it? And actually, this has happened several times in Israel, that parents wanted grandchildren from their soldier who was killed or died, whatever. Do the parents have any stand in it? Can they override the spouse? Do they have to go with the spouse? And so on. And what happens if there are disagreements between the spouse, the father, and the mother? When we say parents, it's not always in agreement. Sometimes the father say, let him alone, he died, let him be buried, and don't bother. And the mother said, I need a grandchild. I want from him a grandchild. So what happens then? Now, if there are disputes, or even without disputes, who is authorized to permit this procedure? Is it a court or is it a public committee? How do we go about it? And another issue is, what would be the status of the newborn? Here is someone who is born. Not only, there are currently situations where a man is undergoing or is expected to undergo chemotherapy or radiotherapy, and we know that he will come sterile. And before he undergoes the treatment, we collect his semen, we freeze it, and if he survives, he can use the sperm in order to have children. So sometimes we use sperm from a person who died, but at least the sperm was obtained with his consent before he died. Here, he doesn't know anything about it. He died without having any knowledge that it's even possible or that he's interested or not interested. And we take out his sperm after he died, and the sperm came into the world after he died. Is there a definition of fatherhood in such a situation? Is the child a legitimate son of this deceased father? For instance, for inheritance questions. If the parents have several children and he is one of them that died, and now his grandson replaces his place, can he be part of the division of the inheritance of his great parent, of his grandparents? Anyway, many complicated situations. So the proposal in the Knesset was that it will be not allowed to obtain sperm from a deceased person and not necessarily a soldier, unless there is an a priori consent that he would like it to be. Except if the person is married and the spouse is interested. So the parents have no status at all. They can't ask for it if we don't know that their son was interested in it. The spouse is allowed to do it. And if the person himself wrote a consent, then you can take it from him. And then we can solve all the other problems. For instance, he can write in his consent that the one to decide if yes or not to take sperm is his mother. So even if the father disagrees, the mother has the authority to do it. Or he can say, even if he's married, I rely on my mother more than on my wife, and whatever she will say, that is what should be done, or whatever combination we can think of. So the idea is that young people should be aware of this option, whether they are soldiers or none. And if they will be knowledgeable that this can be done, they can write such a consent, and that will be acceptable. I discussed it a few years ago before Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg passed away, and he said that the only way to allow such a thing is for a married person who died with the consent of his wife, because that is a chazoket that he really wants it, because to get married, one of the purposes is to have a child. And that is similar to the concept of yibum. what happens in Yibum? If someone dies without children and he has a wife, then the wife can needs to either marry the sibling or give a chalitza, because we assume that he would have wanted a child from this wife. So that chazoke has already roots in the Torah. Are we standing? Continue? Okay. So that is another issue that is ongoing. So maybe next year, Miyad Hashem, when we'll discuss, maybe we'll have already the legislation, how it looks. Next. Let's skip it. This, I think, is easy. Let's skip it. Okay. Next. Next. Okay. Yeah, go back one. Now, this is a story that happened in Israel a few months ago, where, by mistake, a fetus was implanted in a woman that is not the genetic mother of this fertilized egg. So what is the story? Next. The story was that in an IVF clinic, a fertilized egg was returned to a woman that was under fertility treatment. During pregnancy, and that was assumed that this is her fertilized egg in this clinic, like we do all the time. During pregnancy, a serious cardiac anomaly was detected in the fetus. There was an intrauterine surgery done, which was very unusual, very unique, and very complicated, and saved the fetus at that stage. But the physicians wanted to understand what was the basis for the cardiac anomaly of this fetus. And part of the investigation is to do genetic testing. Maybe it's a genetic disorder. And accidentally, they found out that genetically, the woman that carries this fetus couldn't be the genetic mother of this fetus, and her husband as well. So it was clear that by mistake, they took a fertilized egg from woman A and implanted it in this woman who is now pregnant with the baby. So the question was, what do we do in this situation? So what happened was that on the same day, there was another couple that also underwent an implantation. These two couples were treated for infertility, and the time came to do the implant, and the two women got on the same day the implant. So logically, they thought that there was a switch between the two. So now one woman is carrying the fertilized egg from the other woman and vice versa between the two of them. So there was a court order to test the DNA of the second couple on the same day and see if they are the genetic parents. And it turned out negative. That was not the mistake wasn't between the two. At the same time, there were 22 other couples that underwent fertility treatments. There were fertilized eggs of 22 other couples. Obviously, we are talking about many fertilized eggs, because each couple has 10, 15 fertilized eggs times 22. This was the pool on that day in the lab. And all 22 couples wanted to be tested against the fetus to see if they are the genetic parents. In the meantime, there was a court order back and forth. And like you know, in a court, it takes a lot of time. The fetus didn't wait for the court, and he was born. Now we have a baby born. It was a female baby with her cardiac defect. And the court discussions went on. In the meantime, the baby needed an urgent cardiac surgery to correct finally the defect. They did some procedure intrauterinely, but it wasn't the final procedure. So the baby underwent the surgery, was complicated. The nurturing couple, the mother, who, whether she is the mother or not, but she carried all the burden and was with the baby, and so on. So that was at that stage. Next. So what are the dilemmas at this stage? One is, should the mistake have been revealed at all? The lab found out incidentally. They didn't look for the question whether this baby, this fetus, I'm talking about the fetal stage, whether this fetus really belongs to the mother. There was no suspicion that it doesn't belong. They found incidentally this situation. Do they have an obligation to tell it? Now it works. Thank you. Do they have an obligation to reveal it? Next one. Do they have the obligation? Ah, I can do it myself, I see. Oh, thank you.
That's what I'm here for.
That's, you came from Israel for a good purpose. Okay. Now, a similar, although not identical, a condition was discussed by many of the poskim, and that is when, incidentally, by genetic testing, one can find that the alleged parents are not the parents of this child. There's a child who has a genetic problem, and when it's being tested, the mother, the father couldn't be the father of this child. So if this is being revealed, not only will there be a major shalom bayit issue, but the child will be a mamzer, which is a defect that can never be corrected. So many of the poskim, Shlomo Zalman, Abad Yosef, and others say, don't tell. You found an incidental finding that can cause such a tragedy, just don't tell. And we had such two or three incidents that I was involved in, and we decided not to tell. So the husband lives well because he thinks it's his son, and the woman, whatever regret she has, and the child will never be known as a mamzer. And kivan shenitma nitma, and that's one way to get out of it. Should it be the same here? The answer is, first of all, they didn't behave this way. They didn't ask anyone, and they told the story. I mean, the lab people. But it's more complicated than the story that I told. I don't want to go into it further because the fact is that it was told. Now we come to the question, who is the mother? We know now for sure that this woman who delivered the baby is not the genetic mother, but she certainly is the nurturing mother, the surrogate mother. So who is the mother of this child? So she had, this girl has her mother who gave birth to her and has an unknown woman who is her genetic mother. So how do we deal with this? And then this comes back to all questions of egg donations or surrogacy, that we come to this child, who is the mother when motherhood is divided between two women, and Shlomo Zalman and Rabbi Yashiv decided that we can't decide on it. There's not enough sources to decide who is the mother in such a situation, and therefore we look at both women as mothers lechumra. But in this case, it's only the surrogate mother who is a mother lechumra, because we don't know who the genetic mother is. The other issue is that certainly the husband is not the father. He has nothing to do with this child. He didn't carry the pregnancy, obviously, and he didn't give the sperm. The sperm came from another couple. So he has nothing to do with this child. He is like an adopting father who has nothing to do directly with the child. The fourth issue is, let's say we find the genetic mother. What now? Now this child underwent a significant surgery intrauterine, underwent a significant surgery after she was born. She's being raised by this couple who loves the child and knows that it's not their genetic child, but they want to keep the child. And let's say in 5-6 years after all the court the discussions will finish, someone will pop up that she is the genetic mother. Would it make any sense for the best interest of the child to remove the child from this loving parents to another parents who we don't know who they are and how they will treat the child and what connection they'll have with the child? It seems to be that that will be wrong. So the question is, should they look further for the genetic mother or parents? Now what? Oops. You know it's finishing almost. Okay. So what happened? That the challenging couples went to the court and asked to continue to test them against the child and find out who the genetic parents are. But only 6 out of the 22 couples requested a follow-up court order to do the testing towards themselves. And the court ruled, the district court ruled that the testing should go on. The mother that, the surrogate mother appealed to the Supreme Court. There were 3 judges and 2 out of the 3 turned over the district court decision and said that no further testing should be done because, and they talked about the legal aspect, the purely legal aspect. I happen to agree with them from a ethical and halachic point of view, but in the Israeli law, if there is a request to do genetic testing for family purposes, to know who belongs to who, it has to be done by consent of the parent, of the person who has the information or who holds the child. If it is not by their consent, which was the case here, the parents that gave birth to the child refused to the further testings, you can only compel the testings if it's reasonable to find out that there is another parent. They calculated, and I admit I didn't understand the calculation, but the Supreme Court calculated that the 6 couples out of the 22, the chance of one of the 6 is only 4.5% that they'll be found to be the parents. That said, the 2 out of the 3 judges, is not a reasonable chance that they are the parents. And therefore, since the surrogate parent refuses to do the testing, the testing should not be done. And just recently, these 6 couples appealed against the Supreme Court ruling by 3 judges, and they wanted 7 judges to rule on the matter. And sometimes it's done, but just a few weeks ago, the president of the Supreme Court rejected it. She said it's not a very fundamental issue. It's a specific issue. And therefore, there is no further testing. And that's the end of the story in this case. Halachically, I would say that the best interest of the child anyway would be to stay with this couple. And the surrogate mother underwent so much problems and the bonding with the child is so strong that it would make no sense that anyone else who will maybe be discovered as a genetic parent should take over the child. And therefore, I think that what the Supreme Court ruled was the right decision. Okay, thank you.
We'll take 2 questions. Ashi?
Questions for that person on the
gate. You what? Right. So at the moment, luckily or not, you can't obtain eggs postmortem. So it's a technical problem. If it will be able to be done, then it probably will be the same thing. But at the moment, the discussion is only on sperm because technically that's what we can do.
Second question, sorry. What about the question of this child female and male in the future? Are they going to come from the same sperm?
Right. So that is a general question on any sperm donation. If it is very few and statistically it's almost impossible to happen, then we don't relate to it. If it is statistically possible, as it used to be in Israel, that a sperm donor, usually a young student who wants some extra money, goes and donates one time after the other, and it can be 100 donations, out of which there may be 1,000 females have children, and all are brothers from the same father, that created a serious problem. It took some time to the Ministry of Health to realize it. I had a big fight with them, but finally they accepted, and they said that one can donate only 10 samples in his lifetime. 10 samples, let's say, even if it's a few women who get pregnant from it, in 10 million people, probably the chance that they'll meet is very slim. However, they didn't think to the end, and they didn't do a central registry. So what happened was that a fellow comes to Hadassah. By the 10th time, Hadassah said, no more. He said, okay. He goes to Tel HaShomer, and he starts from the beginning because they don't know that he gave already. So it took another while to have a central registry, and now it's settled.
Thank you.
There's someone else? Or... Okay.
Just very quick question. First case of the
government
when the mother was prevented. How did you get consent
in
that case?
No, from it was a court order.
It says by court order.
Right.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Steinberg. I will tell Eddie Reichman that he has worked.
Our next speaker is going to be Rabbi Dr. Aaron Glatt. I'm going to basically tell you a story. I was listening to a shiur, so I apologize. I was listening to a shiur before Pesach, and I heard a wonderful introduction, so I'm going to use that introduction. And the person introducing Rabbi Glatt basically said, Rabbi Glatt, you think you're doing Klal Yisrael any good services these days? He said, the Gemara tells us that ultimately that when we come one day to our day of reckoning, Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to ask us, we're going to learn. Did you set time to learn? Did you set time to think? And people are going to have excuses. So Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to answer, there was nobody poorer than Hillel. You had to go to make a parnasa. There was nobody poorer than Hillel. And he was able to learn. There was nobody more wealthy than Rabbi Yehuda, Anasi. No worries from that point of view. And the Gemara continues with multiple ones. So the speaker turned to Rabbi Glatt. He said, Rabbi Glatt, what are you doing to us? For those that know you, Rabbi Glatt wears multiple hats as well. He is the Rav of the Shul. He was our Saturday night live for a few years of the horrors of COVID, was running and helping Klal Yisro in particular. As in his capacities and in these two worlds, he brings forth, wisdom. I've heard him he's been a speaker here at our conference over the many, many years. He is now the chairman of medicine. He has authored and written many, many papers, books, chapters. Above all, it's a pleasure really, to be able to have him here. Anybody that has worked with him and that has seen him at conferences, he's approachable, can ask Shilas, it's really just a wonderful opportunity to welcome you. Rabbi Glatt is going to speak to us about that word that we don't like to talk about, but it would be good to do a post-mortem on this issue of COVID, and I can't think of a better person than Rabbi Glatt to address us. Rabbi Glatt.
Thank you very, very much, Laser. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be here for such a wonderful conference, as Rabbi Dr. Steinberg mentioned, and it's an honor and a pleasure always to be with Rabbi Dr. Steinberg. One of the conferences I had the pleasure of really giving you a hesped, because it was one of the years you were honored, and I had to give Baruch Hashem the schuss to give the talk about you. So Baruch Hashem, it's an honor to know you, Rabbi Kelman, Rebbetzin Kelman, and Laser and Shana, and all the Torah in Motion staff that we've gotten to know and love over the years. It's a real pleasure and honor to be here. This is the first and only slide that I really have, because I thought I would do this more as not a, as a PowerPoint, but to really give you a, both a personal perspective as well as a medical and halachic and Klal Yisrael perspective of the Gehenim that we were zochet to have for whatever the reason. That's well above my pay grade. If you're asking why did this happen, I don't know. I will explain to you what happened, but I don't know why it happened. And then the next slide is a required slide. I can move it. Okay, which is just to tell you who I am. And the learning objectives, which are to talk a little bit about COVID, but as a shear with medical halachic perspective. So I think I have the zechus of having given the first both medical and halachic shir separately and then together on COVID. Because when I first heard about COVID in December of 19, as an infectious disease physician, it had a certain appeal. God has a sense of humor. And I was very, very interested in it. And before there was a single case in the United States, since I'm the one who runs the grand round schedule, so I said, I knocked off a speaker in January of 2020 when there hadn't yet been a case in the United States, and I gave a medical grand rounds, zero halachic aspect, a pure infectious disease lecture to our hospital in January of 2020. And I remember putting up a slide, because I had this list to be here in Toronto, invited by Rabbi Kelman back in 2003 when SARS unfortunately hit Toronto. And I put up a slide comparing, we didn't call it then SARS-1 and SARS-2, but I pointed out similarities and differences between these two viruses with zero cases in the United States at that point in time, and tried to imagine what this could mean for the world and certainly the United States. I might add very unsuccessfully as a Navi, because my slide said that MERS is so much more dangerous and SARS One was so much more dangerous than this SARS-2, which we didn't know much about yet. And I showed a lot of fancy mortality data from 3 weeks of a pandemic. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu unfortunately had a different plan than my grand rounds for what happened. Then a few weeks later, when things were beginning to blossom across the world, so in my shul, I said, this would be a great, we have a major shir every Shabbos between Mincha and Maariv. So I said, this sounds to me like it'd be a great halachic shir. And I gave in February of 2020. Again, I think we had zero cases at that point in time in our area, but there already had been a handful of cases in the United States. And I gave the halachic implications of this new novel coronavirus. And that was, to my knowledge, obviously the first time that I had heard anybody speak about it, including myself, and it was still a very, very novel and unknown entity. And unfortunately, Nebuch, and I say that with great, great sadness, because we know we have members of our community here, Olav Shalom, that passed away. We had several doctors that had been at some of these medical ethic conferences that aren't with us, and a tremendous tragedy. And all of us have friends, colleagues, family members, people in our community that Nebuch passed away. So I would like to give you my personal perspective on this, what we can learn from this from a Klal Yisrael point of view, highs and lows, and to talk about what happened, both from a personal point of view, but as well from a Tzibur point of view. And once we had unfortunately, begun to realize the seriousness of this issue. So all the Rabbanim in my community got together. And this was right around Purim of that year. And the exact date, my wife always reminds me of these things. So March 13th was the Thursday night. The 12th was a Wednesday night. 12th was a Thursday? Okay. So it was the Wednesday and Thursday right after Purim. And on Wednesday night, we had 40, 50 Rabbanim in our community gathered together. And I presented what I thought were the medical as well as some halachic facts at that time. We had three great Gedolei HaPoskim with us as all of the community Rabbanim from surrounding areas were there. We had Rav Herschel Schechter Shlita, Rav Mordechai Willig Shlita, Rav David Cohen Shlita. And we presented to them the information as to what we should do. All the shuls were open at that point in time. All of the normal things were going on in communities, kiddushes, weddings, all the sorts of things that Baruch Hashem are so beautiful to have. Needless to say, everybody was gathering. There was no mass. There was no distancing. It wasn't a habamin. We didn't have a single case yet at that point in time in Nassau County. Only Nebuch, a few weeks earlier, they started having cases in the New York metropolitan area. And the question was raised what we should do. And based upon the medical presentation, the halachic understanding of what our risks were, so the poskim at that point decided that we were not going to close. So on Wednesday night, wasn't unanimous amongst all the Rabbanim. But the psak from our, quote, basin of three gedolim, as well as the gestalt from the community Rabbanim, many of who were gedolim in their own rights, was not to close. And on Thursday night, I had, again, multiple conversations individually with Rav Schechter Shlita and Rav Mordechai Willig Shlita as to what we should do. And I still felt that medically, we didn't have our first case yet. There were no cases. And to close everything down based upon no cases, but just really hearsay as to what was going on elsewhere was a difficult thing to do. And you really were talking about massive changes in Jewish life. And then the next morning, early in the morning, I got notification that unfortunately we now were having cases in the hospital. And they didn't just have one case. There was really a mini explosion overnight in terms of recognizing that we had a serious problem in the hospital. And when I went to shul that morning, all I could hear in shul was people coughing. I had already put out a policy 3 weeks beforehand that if anybody has any symptoms, it's also for them to come to shul. With the haskama of Rav Schechter Shlita and Rav Willig Shlita. And in my neighborhood, those are the poskim amongst all the rabbanim, or many, many of the rabbanim. And we were telling people, if you're sick, do not come to shul. It's also for you to daven tefillah b'tzibur. You have no right to do so. And I remember sitting there in shul during some of the quieter parts of davening, and all I could hear was people coughing. And immediately after davening, I hadn't taken off my tefillah. I called up Rabbi Willig Shlita, my Rebbe Mufak, and I said, Rebbe, we have to close everything down. I think there's real sakonis nefashos. And the Rebbe said, if that's what you think, that's what we're going to do. And Baruch Hashem, everybody closed down that Friday morning. All the Rabbanim, we sent out a message. I would say 95 to 98% of the shuls in the five towns area and in the surrounding area closed. And shortly afterwards, unfortunately, the entire country shut down. And unfortunately, every country eventually shut down because it was pure sakonas nefashos. And it was by far the most difficult decision I've ever had to make in my life. And I know Rabbi Willig Shlita got tremendous, tremendous pushback from a lot of Rabbanim on why he was closing down. Because Aaron Glatt saying much doesn't mean that much. Rabbi Willig, Rav Schechter, say to close things down. So then everything closed down. And the same people, Rabbi Willig Shlita told me this himself, the same Rabbanim, Hashiva Rabbanim, that had called him up originally and were upset with him, to use the term mildly. How dare you close everything down? Based on what? There really were very, very few cases at that point in time. And those same Rabbanim, many of them Hashiva Rabbanim, Rabbi Willick told me, they called him up afterwards and said, how many lives were saved? Because that Shabbos, at least, people weren't in shul together. And Nebuch, again, I don't want to say this, it's so sad. How many people were nifta from this terrible, terrible machala? Worldwide, the estimated numbers from the WHO, probably at most, are a third off. That they're estimating 10 million people, it's probably closer to 25, 30 million people worldwide have died from COVID. And it's probably an underestimate because we have no way of knowing how many people didn't die directly of COVID, but died because they didn't seek medical care. How many people didn't want to go to a hospital, had a heart attack at home. That's just chest pain and didn't wake up the following morning. There's no way to estimate all of those numbers because the emergency rooms should have theoretically not seen a decrease in the number of heart attacks. What does that have to do with COVID? Shouldn't be less, but the numbers of all the other diseases dramatically decreased because I know our emergency room in our hospital was at one point in time 80 to 85% COVID. So granted, we didn't do elective surgery. Granted, we didn't take in anybody that absolutely didn't need to be in the hospital, but Rahman al-Islam, strokes, cancer, heart attacks, all sorts of other mahalas, many of them probably went underdiagnosed, underrecognized, and people died. They died of COVID. No, they didn't necessarily die of COVID. They may have had COVID, but they didn't necessarily die of COVID. So I suspect that the numbers that are thrown out there in the tens of millions are probably underestimates, and probably at least 25, if not more, million people have died of COVID, which again, I think, unfortunately, is in part due to people not always following what the Gedolei HaPoskim and the Gedolei HaMumchim, the experts. And this is a problem, but it wasn't a problem right away. I want to tell you again, personal experiences. So this was the world that I lived in. I live in many different worlds. I have a smicha from the Sheder Halevi's grandson, Sat Marov Dayan, and I am also a member of B'nai Akiva. I'm also a member of Aguda, a member of the Igud. So I fit in with nobody and everybody, or I try to, because I don't like the fact that people are labeled based upon what color yarmulke they wear or don't wear, what color hat they wear or do wear. Don't wear. These things are unimportant. The only thing that I was ever taught was if you're Shomer Torah Mitzvahs, that's all that counts. And that's why I'm so happy to give this talk on Yom Yerushalayim. Because Yom Yerushalayim is something that should connect the entire Jewish people. I heard had a shir with Rav Rudny Shlita. He's on the Moetzes HaGedola of the Aguda. And we were talking about Eretz Yisrael. And he says, whatever your feelings about the Medina and whatever your feelings are about what's going on in Eretz Yisrael, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has allowed Medina Yisrael to exist and flourish, and the amount of Torah and the amount of Yiddishkeit spirituality because we have Medina Yisrael is unbelievable. So well, whatever your feelings are, you're going to say Taklim tomorrow, you're going to say Hallel mit the Bracha, without the Bracha. Those are halachic arguments. But in your heart, every person has to have an understanding that what? We have Yerushalayim again, something that the 2,000 years, everybody says, Lashon HaBav Yerushalayim. We don't have the Yerushalayim that we want. We daven every day, Yerushalayim HaBnuyah, but at least we can go there. During COVID, one of the most heartfelt things that I personally felt was, for the first time in almost all of my life, you couldn't go to Eretz Yisrael. It was closed. I know what my parents, my Zaydis, my Babas, and their parents and Babis and Zaydis felt, that it's just a dream. So for the first time in our lives, we couldn't go to Eretz Yisrael. And Baruch Hashem, we have children late Aliyah, I have grandchildren there, so we were able to get in on the next wave when first degree relatives were allowed to come in. But for many people, they couldn't visit Eretz Yisrael. It was tragedy of tragedies. So on Yom Yerushalayim, especially, I'm so happy to give this talk because at the beginning of COVID, there was an unbelievable unity. And I was happy to be a small part of getting the Aguda, the Lakewood based in, the Etzes, the RCA, the Igud HaRabbanim, the National Council of Young Israel, every major Jewish organization in the United States jointly put out, at least the first time in my life, a statement saying what Klal Yisrael had to do. And again, this was all of the Shomer Torah Mitzvahs, quote, branches of Klal Yisrael. Rav Shechter Shlita always says that that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the Yom Suf split into 12, some say 13 paths, because each Shevet had its own path. And that's because there's not one way to get to the other side. There's not one way to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There are many ways to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Not that Reuven's way is better than Shimon's way, which is better than Yehuda's way, better than Don's way. Lots of different ways to get there. And all of these Orthodox groups, Baruch Hashem, were united. There were always people that didn't follow the advice of Gedolim. And that to me was the saddest part. We are a people that believe our Torah HaKdosha in Shulchan Aruch, it's passing, it's not just Hashkofa, that we're supposed to follow the advice of Mumchim. If somebody who has knowledge says you're Mechuyev to be Mechal Shabbos, you're called the Chosid Shota, you're a Rotseach, if you're not Mechal Shabbos, for Pikuach Nefashos. Nebuch, I know stories from Hatzolah and from personal experiences where people say, nah, I'm not going to the Hasel Shabbos, just indigestion. And then they died of indigestion 2 hours later when they had a massive MI. And how many people said, I'm not going to fast on Yom Kippur? I know somebody once told me, I was in Auschwitz and I didn't eat on Yom Kippur. I ain't eating on Yom Kippur now. There's a famous one of the Tosafists that he didn't eat on Yom Kippur. He didn't think he would die if he didn't eat on Yom Kippur. He died a short while afterwards. And the post can talk about him being held accountable for not doing what the halacha says. And the halacha says, if the rofei mumchim say you're mechuyev to be mechal Shabbos, you're mechuyev to take this medication, unless you are an equally qualified rofei mumcha, you have to listen to the rofei mumcha. And that's the psak halacha. That's not just good medical advice. That's the halacha. And I had the schus to speak to the Moetzes HaGedola, to present to them what the facts were on the ground with COVID. And I had the tremendous schus to speak with the Novominsky Rebbe. So hard to say, Zatzal still at this point, he died about 6 weeks after I spoke with him of COVID. And I heard myself, this isn't Shmuel Mipi'ish, I heard the Novominsky say to the Moetzes HaGedola that the Torah cannot be Megan, Shchicha, Hezeka, the Torah cannot be Megan. What does that mean? When there is a high likelihood of danger, you cannot rely upon Tefillah, you cannot rely upon the Torah to protect you. You must do what is right. You're wrong if you think, well, I can go to Minyan, I can go to my Seder, I can have the kolel stay open, I can have absolutely no change, when shchicha hezeka, when it was unfortunately very, very likely that this would be trouble. I heard myself with my own ears, the Novominsky tell the other Gedolim on the Moetzes, we got to close down. Shchicha hezeka. And everybody listened. The Novominsky spoke. Everybody listened. And I will tell you that the Levaya, the greatest action that I think I have ever seen in my life from a Gadol, is when Nebuch the Novominsky died a short while later. You see the funerals of Gedolim, right? When Moshe Feinstein, I remember, I was at Moshe Feinstein's Levaya. There were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. Remember this, I was a third-year resident, and one of my co-residents lived on the Lower East Side. And he was somewhat involved in taking care of emotions. So he shut me along. And I'm so happy I went. You know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people with emotions, Lubavitch. I heard Rav Avadya Yosef's Levaya in Eretz Yisrael, there were probably close to 1 million people in his Levaya. How many people were the Novi Minsker's Levaya? The Novi Minsker said, and I saw a picture, he said, it's also to come to my Levaya. He told his son to tell everybody, nobody comes to my Levaya, it's Pikuach Nefashos. And I saw a picture of the Kvura. I don't know if there was a minion there. There was a handful of people. That's a God. That's a God. In my opinion, that was one of the greatest acts of godless that I've seen, when he understood that if people come to give Kavod HaTorah to him, it's a death sentence potentially. And he said, nobody's allowed to come to my Levaya. That's the psak of a Gadol, based upon the medical experts. And it's critically important for us to understand that that's the way halacha works. You ask the experts, you follow their advice. And that's what Klal Yisrael did. But then unfortunately, and I don't know why, all of a sudden, everybody became an infectious disease expert. I can tell you right now, about half the positions in the United States in infectious diseases are unfilled. I don't know why. They should just go out to the street and there's plenty of infectious disease people out there. Everybody became a mumcha. One of my favorite slides is I have a picture of somebody who's having difficulty doing his fifth grader's child's homework in math. He says, yeah, but I'm an infectious disease expert. And all of a sudden, unfortunately, this creeped into halacha, because you had people with the name rabbi in front of them, and people sometimes even with the name doctor in front of them, that didn't have a clue as to what the medical facts are, and therefore couldn't paskin correctly. Leni Estati, I'm sorry. They're just not paskin correctly if you don't know the facts. Remember, Shach the Shlita would say over the Ravs, Yashiva Soloveitchik, I've said this story over a number of times. If you've heard it again, please forgive me, because it's such a powerful story. That in the days when they started having the watches, that if you moved your hand, so the watch wound, great technology. So somebody asked the Rav, Shach told over this story. He was there. Somebody asked the Rav, are you allowed to use such a watch on Shabbos? I remember the Shach is saying over the name of the Rav. I had the schluss to meet the Rav on a couple of occasions. I was just a teenager, never had a idea of who he was at that time. I never learned it in him, but my Rebbein did. And Rav Shach would say, oh, the Rav said, the boys bring me a screwdriver. And the Rav took the watch apart. I asked Rav Shach a couple of times, he never answered me. Did the Rav put it back together? And he looked. I had a little chutzpah as a teenager. And the Rav looked at the mechanism. He said, how can I pass the shayla if I don't know the mechanism? It's in Shulchan Aruch, it's a nevuah. You have to know what the facts are. And that is the way a gadol paskins. And unfortunately, during the Sefirah time, between Pesach and Shavuos, things started to change. Unfortunately, we had two joint announcements from all of those groups. And then afterwards, we couldn't get joint announcements. Everybody went on their own ways. And unfortunately, we lost that chance. I was absolutely convinced. I was absolutely convinced that Mashiach was coming. I said, what other purpose could HaKadosh Baruch Hu have for COVID other than to get all these groups together and be united? Vayichan ha'am tachas ha'har. We're all together united. And I really, really, truly thought, I actually told it to somebody at that time. I was expected to be written up next week in Mishpacha magazine or Ami. He predicted Mashiach was coming. Yeah. We hope and pray tomorrow still, Yom Yerushalayim. Wouldn't that be great if Mashiach came on Yom Yerushalayim? But unfortunately, this is where the unity of COVID unfortunately left us. And the most important thing I learned from that is humility. And we, as physicians, need to understand that. You know, I don't think one time that any of the infectious disease people, and I talk with a lot of infectious disease people, but in our system, we have people that are really mumchim. Plus, I know other people. I just had a conversation last week with Dr. Deborah Howry, who's the chief medical officer of the CDC. I did a fireside chat with her. And, you know, we talked and we said, yeah, we don't know everything, but never at any point in time, to my knowledge, did any infectious disease person ever intentionally, maliciously, on purpose, do something wrong. We based each of us to the best of our abilities to follow what the facts said. And people sometimes are upset that facts change. In medicine, you know, if you're practicing medicine the way you did 25 years ago, 35 years ago, 5 months ago, you're probably not being a very good doctor. And I remember, again, many of you have heard me say this as well, that when I went to medical school, one of my guardianship professors said that, I want you boys and girls all to know, it's mostly boys then, I want you boys and girls to know that 50% of what we teach you is wrong. And your job is to figure out which 50%. Very smart, very true. Facts change. Everything's an infectious disease now. An ulcer is now an infectious disease. Plaque formation is probably an infectious disease. There's a lot of stuff that we don't know what's going on, but we do the best that we can. And just to illustrate another point, and this is written down in Dr. Abraham Sefer, in the Nishma Sabram. Dr. Abraham, I had this to meet again on a number of occasions, God told me Yisrael. And he writes down in a Sefer, a word from Rosh Shlomo Zalman. He was very, very close to Rosh Shlomo Zalman Zatzal. And he said, who should we paskin like? Should we paskin like the opinion of Shmuel, who's brought down that said that a person shouldn't do a lot of exercise? Shmuel's an Amora. And Shmuel said, don't do exercise because you only have a certain amount of steps, so to say, to take in your life, and let people carry you around. You'll live much longer because once you use up your steps, that's it. Or should we pass it like the Rambam? Rambam said, the Rambam's a Rishon. Rambam's the Rambam, he's a Rishon. Although he does argue with Amorayim, usually an Amora trumps a Rishon. So what is the Rambam's position? The Shvil has a Havia, do exercise. So Shlomo Zalman said, as quoted by the Mishnah Sabram, he says, you don't follow Amora versus Rishon in this situation, you follow the medical advice. And Shmuel was basing upon what they held in the academy of Nardoi, where he was the Goyin, where he was the Rosh Yeshiva, and the Pumbedisa Journal of Medicine, so they held that exercise wasn't good. And the Rambam's already passing like the Cairo Journal of Medicine, and they said exercise is good. And if they change today, then you don't follow the Rambam, you don't follow Shmuel, you follow what the medical experts say, and that's how halacha is based. But with humility, the doctors have to understand, and that's something that never we realized we made mistakes all the time, never intentional. And the biggest mistake we probably make is not recognizing how important it was to have good understanding of how infectious this disease was and through which mechanisms it was infectious. And my great advice in January of 2020, don't come to shul if you're sick, was certainly correct, but incomplete. Because you were highly contagious in the days before you became symptomatic. If we'd only known that, we'd have closed the shuls back in January. We didn't know that. Can't fault anybody for not knowing that, but that's probably the single biggest mistake, the single most costly mistake that we made in not knowing, how could we know, the appropriate way that this illness is transmitted in the pre-symptomatic stage. And that led to many other things that unfortunately we wouldn't be successful with in terms of masking policies, which were sometimes, you know, controversial to say the least. Now, I will tell you, there's not a shadow of evidence to suggest otherwise. Not even a half a minute to think that a N95 one probably doesn't work. It absolutely does. The problem with the general masking policies is, A, most people don't wear an N95. Most people wear their surgical mask around their neck as a scarf and has zero value there, unless you happen to have a trach. And if everybody's not doing it, it diminishes its value. Even then, these masking policies probably saved lives, but nowhere near as much as we were hoping for. And the other biggest mistake that I wish I could go back in time and correct is that probably outdoor minyanim probably could have continued throughout. The one thing I regret is that we stopped all minyanim. Whereas I think outdoor minyanim would have been safe even in the heart of the epidemic, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu made a better filtration system than any HEPA filters that we have, or any 14 and 15 MERS filters. The outside atmosphere is a great way to stop the dissemination of illness, and probably spacing people, having outdoor minyanim, probably would have been a very, very safe thing to do. You look back and you say, well, if we had known, but we didn't know. And I think we did an unbelievably good job, and the vaccines have probably saved tens of millions of lives worldwide. And it's very painful sometimes to see such fighting in Klal Yisrael for the vaccines. All the rabbanim in my community made a video about the importance of getting vaccinated, which, again, every single rabbi I discussed this with said at least you should get vaccinated. Some said it's a chiv to get vaccinated, but not one rab, Gadol B'Yisrael, that I spoke with, in any way suggested that you should not get vaccinated. Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, maybe well, Shlita, stated, follow your doctor's advice. Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky is not known as being a gadol that is in favor of vaccinations in general. He said, follow your doctor's advice. That was the least enthusiastic gadol's response. Follow your doctor's advice. There's not one single infectious disease doctor in the United States, and I've asked on public, find one infectious disease doctor that doesn't recommend vaccination for COVID. And you, unfortunately, have people that don't have that knowledge that are recommending not to vaccinate. We have, unfortunately, people that are putting out videos, people putting out advertisements saying that there are treatments. This is published in many Jewish newspapers. Unfortunately, maybe you've seen it. There are now treatments available to detoxify you in case you got vaccinated, so you'll be eligible to have a shidduch. I wish I was making this up. And this is unfortunately the period in Klal Yisrael and the going away from what Shulchan Aruch tells us we have to do. The highlight, and I'll close with this, of my professional involvement with COVID was when President Biden invited me to the White House to light the menorah in recognition of some of the things we had done. The low light of my COVID perspective is getting death threats and having to go to the police. And the death threats were written, you're a rotseach, in those words, not that you're a murderer. You're a rotseach, and that you're a Nazi. My mother, Aleha Shalom, who was an Auschwitz survivor, to call me a Nazi because I advocated a vaccine. You don't want to take the vaccine? Don't take the vaccine. I didn't make money off the vaccine. While I was on Saturday Night Live, they did not pay me the salary that the Saturday Night Live people got. I don't know what they get, but I didn't get that money. People were giving honest medical advice, and it's a shame. And this was the most difficult part of COVID, the lack of achdus in Klal Yisrael. So I'll conclude with a story about my mother, because it's Yom Yerushalayim. My mother had a very difficult hard life. She was an Auschwitz survivor. Her entire family was destroyed, killed, murdered in one day by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam Zichron. She had one sister that survived the war with her, and she buried her Nebuch in Bergen-Belsen right after the war ended. She died of typhus, probably. My mother was on the first Chever Kaddish of Bergen-Belsen. When they liberated the camp, she asked for a shovel. That's all she wanted. She wanted food. She wanted anything. She wanted a shovel to bury her sister. Shem Yimkom Dama. So I want to tell you what happened in 1967 when I came home from school as a little boy. And I see my mother sitting on the stoop with a smile on her face. Now, My mom was the most wonderful person in the world, the strongest person I know. I never saw her with a smile on her face. Not once do I recall seeing my mom in my youth with a smile on her face. Tough as nails, but not a smile on her face. And she had the most unbelievable smile. Huge. Lit up this room. I remember this like it was yesterday. I was 9 years old coming home from school. And she's sitting on the stoop of our apartment building, waiting for me to get off the school bus. And I see her, I go up to her, Mom, what happened? No, I was 9 years old, but I was enough to realize something was going on. Huge smile on her face. And it will never leave my mind. I remember it like it was yesterday. My mom said, Yerushalayim is ours. Yerushalayim is ours. The unity of Klal Yisrael. That's how we'll get the Beis HaMikdash back. I really think we came this close in COVID. Let's hope it doesn't take another pandemic to have us rebuild the Beis HaMikdash b'mehera b'yameinu. Thank you for listening.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you.
I think that was my mom. Don't talk about me.
Test, Carrie. Test.
So, debating but it still remains a paradox that the countries that were very strict in terms of their policies did not, from many standpoints, may not have done much better than other countries that did not have strict policies. And so maybe you could address that, because it's sure. Something that I don't understand.
Sure. So I think public health measures are a lot different than what you might do for your personal self under many situations. And people that are in public health officials have to have a certain understanding of the way public health works. Every single baby born in the United States has to have drops put in their eyes to prevent them from getting ophthalmic gonorrhea. Now, in certain communities, not really much of a problem, Baruch Hashem. In other communities, it's a problem. But they put those drops in every baby's eyes because that's a good public health measure. And I tried very hard not to have those drops put into my first child when he was born. They said, I really didn't think it was necessary. And they told me they will take my baby away from me, have a legal guardian take over the baby, put the drops, and then they'll give the baby back. Because that's public health. You do things that aren't necessarily in the best interest of one particular patient, but as a society, it will help improve society. And we can debate that back and forth on that particular subject, or in general policies. Now, I will tell you, I never was a fan of closing public schools. We fought very, very much to keep the yeshivas open, and only for a very short time did the yeshivas close. I think a lot of our knowledge about how severe and not severe COVID was, we did not realize, because there were a lot of cases in children, but they were nowhere near what could have been if we had done things differently. So I do think that there was an appropriate time to close certain things down. I personally did not agree with some of the public health policies, but I understood them. And you have to understand that even to this day and time, there are unfortunately differences in mortality from COVID in red states in the United States versus blue states, or the provinces here. I don't know if you have differences in Canada. Do you have red provinces and blue provinces out here in Canada?
Yeah.
So I don't know what your public health data shows, but there are differences in mortality. And the reasons why these massive closures don't work is because they're only temporary measures. Look what happened in China when they opened up. All of a sudden, well, all the unexposed people are going to get sick. So public health is a very different type of medicine than an individual practicing medicine in an office. And what I'll do for an individual patient would be totally different than we do at the hospital. Today, in our hospital, I ended the pandemic. I announced today in our hospital that we no longer have to do pre-admission testing of every single patient coming into the hospital for COVID. We reached a point, we did some studies, and we don't think it's cost-effective. So as of today, the pandemic is over because we no longer are testing people that have no symptoms, that have no exposure. So we've come full swing. So I gave the first talk back in January, and today I hopefully gave the last talk of the epidemic, of the pandemic. Now it's an epidemic. We'll do things differently. So things change from a public health point of view. Until today, and we're actually going to change it over this weekend, we required mandatory testing of every patient coming into the hospital. Does that make good sense on an individual patient? Says, no, I had COVID, 6 months ago. I probably don't have COVID. I had 5 vaccinations. Well, for that patient, it doesn't make sense. But you can't make public health policies for individual patients. They have to be sweeping across the board so you can carry them out. So things do change. And yes, some of the things that were done were probably not in the best overall public health, but they were never done. And that's what people have to understand. They were never done maliciously. I don't know a single person at the CDC or in public health or in our system or amongst the other systems that I work closely with. One person that's a bad person that said, we're going to do this just to make everybody upset. People did what they thought was best. And that's all HaKadosh Baruch Hu asked us ever to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Glatz. Really appreciate the overview. And hopefully, as you said, this will be a distant memory. It really gives me great pleasure now to call upon our final speaker for the evening. That'll be Rabbi Shlomo Brody. Rabbi Shlomo Brody comes to us for the first time, and it's really a pleasure. And I didn't know that his skill is really getting AV equipment to work. Had I known that, but thank you very much for that. Rabbi Shlomo Brody is now the head of the executive director of the halachic organ of what used to be called the Halachic Organ Donor Society. I say that because now you're director of the AMATAI program, but for people that have been following, we have been talking about the HODS, the Halachic Organ Donations Donor Society, for many, many years here at our conferences. So you're stepping into something that has a new name, new branding, and we're all looking forward to being able to hear what this is all about. And you're taking over a legacy with Rabbi Tendler, of course, as leading the HODS Society. For those that may know that if you read the Jerusalem Post, you can always go through your halacha every day. You can read the Jerusalem Post and get words of wisdom. Rabbi Shlomo Brody, previously, that's where we met initially. My son was at Yeshiva Kotel, and Rabbi Brody was one of the senior rabbanim at that time. And so we met a few years ago back then. So it's really nice to get reacquainted again. Extensively written up many places, and really a pleasure to have you join our conference. He's going to speak to us tonight about a topic which, ironically, is really Canadian-made, no pun intended, or maybe pun intended, made and religious policy. This is a much bigger issue here in Canada, I don't know how much it's going to be affecting the United States, but certainly this is something that we struggle with. We have had topics, and we've spoken about this in the past, but I think it would be really wonderful to hear your thoughts on this. Rabbi Brody.
Bye. We get the PowerPoint up if no, I don't know how to do this.
Oh, very good.
Okay, so it's an honor and pleasure to be here. And thank you to Dr. Freeman, to the Kelmans. It's an honor and pleasure also to be here with Rabbi Professor Steinberg and Rabbi Glatt. We're members of AMATAI's Rabbinic Advisory Committee. And I really actually like the fact that we have, I got the batteries now, it doesn't work for me. Angle. Okay, so now this slide, the next one. I think every pulpit rabbi should have to do this before their drasha. Imagine every Shabbos. If you told the rabbis, make sure your drasha has an objective, and only one or two, and that's it. Actually, things are doing much better. I'm just pointing that out as an aside. I'm not a pulpit rabbi, so I can say that. But here are our objectives tonight. Is the sound working okay, by the way? You can hear me in the back? You're sure? Too loud. I'll tell you my issue. Every time I speak in public, I have this ongoing nightmare. There are variations, but it goes something like this. I'm 3 minutes in. Someone in the back row says, "We can't hear you." Someone in the front row says, "I can. Do you want to switch?" So you can hear me, right? And if I see you guys get up and move, I'm going to be insulted. Okay. So with enough jokes, let's talk about euthanasia. Yeah, all right. So in Israel, we call it a mavar chad. We go from a serious topic, talking about the Eurovision, mavar chad. Here's a mavar chad. So MAID stands for medical assistance in dying. It is the euphemism, in my mind, for what we call used to call euthanasia and or physician-assisted suicide. And it's not only in Canada, of course, where this is going on. Many states in Australia, New Zealand, Belgium, Netherlands, a few other places. But I want to focus on MAID in Canada because I think medical care and end-of-life care in the West is undergoing a radical change. And we have to be aware of this as citizens and as Jews. And unfortunately, we're not aware of it enough. So a month or two ago, I had a meeting with the chief rabbi's office in the United Kingdom. And I said to not with the chief rabbi himself, he knows about the meeting, but others, I said to them, Rabosai, you don't understand, but euthanasia is on its way in the UK. It's going to radically change what's available. And he said, no, it's been proposed before. It's come up, it always fails in parliament. I said to you, I promise you. And I called up the chief rabbi's medical advisor, Professor David Katz. I said to him, David, you got to get them on this. This is serious. And if they don't believe you, look at what's going on in Canada. Okay. Now, MAID, these are the rules in general. And I say 18 years of age and older, although, as the doctors will know, that's a little bit being fidgeted right now, maybe a little bit of a mature minor as well. It has to be from a person's capacity to make healthcare decisions. It must provide informed consent. They have to be eligible. I mean, we don't want to have tourists coming here for this. And they have to be diagnosed with a grievous and irremediable medical condition where a person must meet all the following criteria: a serious and incurable illness, advanced state of irreversible decline, and experiencing enduring physical or physiological suffering. This is a change from 2016. In 2016, when the law was originally passed, it had to be a situation where death was reasonably foreseeable. That was changed to allow it to be done earlier. Now we're going to see what the statistics are of the consequence of this. Now, the other factor which came up is that this was supposed to be enacted in the law as well, that as of March 2023, mental illness as the sole underlying medical condition was enough of a reason to request and be given euthanasia. Which means you have no right. The sole issue is a question of mental illness. And that in of its own right would make you eligible to receive euthanasia. Now, because of a certain public pushback, because let's think about this. We're only talking about mental health. I'm not minimizing mental health by any means. But if you have access to good mental health care, then maybe you wouldn't want euthanasia. And maybe not everyone has good access to mental health care, which of course we know is true. And so there's this pushback, at least it's been delayed to 2024. We'll see where it goes from here. Now let's look at the numbers to understand what the consequence is. Okay, so these are the total number of deaths in Canada. And you'll see in 2021, over 10,000 people died in Canada from euthanasia. That's over 3% of deaths in Canada from euthanasia. Now, there's no doubt in 2022, maybe some doctors will disagree with me, but I think it's pretty clear. The numbers are certainly going to be higher. We don't know those numbers yet. So 10,000 people every year in Canada die, I don't want to put it this way, but for lack of a better term, at the hand of their doctors. You notice also I circled Ontario and Quebec. Now, Ontario has about 1.5 times the population of Quebec. You'll see, though, that the numbers are almost a little bit higher in Quebec, which means that in Quebec, it's happening a lot. Now, it's interesting, there's been a little bit of pushback, and this is very important to understand. The pushback here originally was from the right, from the conservative right, Catholics and others. And most recently, there's been a pushback from the political left as well. I think this is very important on a political level. And basically, the argument has become now, this isn't about conservatism. This is about human rights. And what's going to happen here is who, of course, is going to be quicker to be given and take the option of euthanasia, the disabled, people with less access to healthcare, the poor, people who are seen by society as burdens. And this is important because on the left as well now, there's a little bit of awakening to say that we have some issues here. And you can see this in some of the polls that are being done. So if you see here, for example, So you see here the support for MAID when it was changed to not just to be about reasonable, right? That you could tell someone's terminally ill, right? Actually went up. There is the changes in 2021. There is even greater support for it in the Canadian public opinion, which is why, by the way, I think there's very little chance of MAID being pulled back entirely. Meaning the Americans here are thinking, Roe v. Wade, whether you like, we'll talk about Roe v. Wade coming up, whether you like Roe v. Wade or not, it took 50 years, it was revoked. I don't think that's happening so quickly in Canada, but those of you here will have your opinions on this. But what was interesting is that in 2023, when it became a mental health question, there was a lot of opposition. Meaning people are starting to say, whoa, we got to hold back on expanding this. We have to understand what exactly we're doing and what's going on. And that's significant. Now, so you see here again as well, but look at, if you look also, you notice, now it's working too fast. So you see here in 2016, when they discussed mental health, vast majority said, no, that can't be the sole criterion. Today, the majority still say, but look how the numbers have changed. So on the one hand, society is saying, slow down. It's not saying stop. And I heard a lecture recently, I had a conversation with a former head of the Canadian Medical Association. We'll speak about him a little bit later on as well, who said to me, 2024, this is moving forward. Meaning this is just a delay until we set better protocols. I don't know if he's a nubby or not, but he's probably right. Now, it's interesting to see who supports it and who doesn't. This is significant. If you look here, you'll see that if you're not religious, you support MAID. Overwhelming numbers. Tremendous amount of numbers. And you see as it goes on, people become a little bit more, I don't even know what spiritually uncertain means. Like, I'm not sure non-religious means you're an atheist. This one's like, nah, I don't know exactly how you define this. But as you get a little bit more religious, a little bit more, the numbers change, the religiously committed are fairly against MAID. Although even there, let's look at the numbers. I mean, still talking about 28%, it's a quarter, right? Which means that in the religious community, I'm not talking about Jewish, talking about the broader religious community, there's some support, but not a tremendous amount of support. Now, this is also an interesting stat. Do you agree or disagree? The increasing prevalence of MAID has cheapened the value of human life in Canada. If you're not religious, no change at all. 75%. The religious think, absolutely. This is changing how we understand the value of human life. So the disparity here of red and blue, so to speak, Rabbi Glad, you're getting to red and blue here, is not about states, but is largely driven by religion. Which is a fascinating phenomenon. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. I am worried that MAID will be a replacement for adequate social services in Canada. Many, many people are worried about this, which is remarkable because so many people are supportive of MAID. And yet when you ask them, wait a minute, is MAID going to transform the notion of how we think about social services in Canada? Are we now going to have as a default, well, you're old, you're sick, et cetera, what's going to happen? Are we going to offer social services? People are worried. The default is just going to be, we have an easy out for you, which is remarkable because if you look at the numbers, people are still very supportive of it. which highlights in my mind, if you look at the stats on this, is that there is a moment right now in Canadian society where there's a little bit of confusion about this. On the one hand, support remains because people don't want to see people suffering. On the other hand, there is some concern in religious circles for sure, but not just, about questions of human rights and about questions about how this is transforming Canadian society. And so in my mind, in some ways, we have a moment, which might be a brief moment, but a moment in which there is importance for communities, for citizens to speak out, both about this in Canada, but in other places as well when they're exploring this issue. Now, I know when I started to speak about to a number of the rabbis here in Canada about this issue, so one of the very prominent rabbis here said to me as follows, the local from Jewish and Muslim medical students are being told medicine might not be for you. Because of the direction which is going in, you might not be wanting this be a part of this profession. That's a scary thought. I'm not sure he's totally right because other people don't agree with that. But you understand that there's a lot of talk right now of a nervousness in various medical circles and rabbinical circles. I'm in touch with a number of Catholic colleagues here as well who are saying that we must talk about this. Now, let's clarify a couple of things about these issues. When Halacha thinks about this question, I want to put it on the table straight up. It's important to say, I think this is totally usher. Okay. And this should be something which we should understand to be true. I stress this because I promise you, I know for a fact that Jews, including traditional Jews, including some places of Orthodox Jews, who are suffering, and I'm not judging them by one means, are utilizing medical assistance in dying. Here and other places as well, there are 10 states in the United States where physician-assisted suicide is legalized, plus District of Columbia. And there are some very interesting shilas that have come up in various hospitals, California, other places. Right, where they know, right, we know how people died. So this is a real phenomenon. I'm not judging anyone. I promise you, I'm not judging anyone. People are suffering. But we should understand the halakha has a very clear stance upon this. Self-inflicted wounds, killing is a problem. And it's very interesting. Kavah Kabbalah, through Mecklenburg, 19th century, makes the following point on this pasuk in Bereishit. He says there are two different ways in which humans kill each other. One is in an evil way. Jealousy, anger, whatever it might be. And there is another type of murder, which is the type when you're doing it for the sake of the person. Nonetheless, that's usher as well. So intentions might be good in some cases, right? We understand we're trying to relieve and alleviate suffering, but the halacha is clear about this being asur. Now, you might say to me, wait a minute, aren't there all these stories in the Torah and Tanakh and Chazal of various cases of suicide or even murder or killing our own children, avoiding the Crusades? Yes, those stories are all there. They're super important. They're very interesting. They tell us a lot about what we think about the importance of quality of life and pain, which, as I'm going to argue momentarily, we do care very much about. But I'm not going to take from exceptional cases of Agadata in various forms or another, right, a broader rule on this issue, right? We know the story of Chanana ben Tradion and other cases like this. There are cases where this comes up. There are cases historically, but this was certainly not the rule. I think everyone in the world of Jewish medical ethics understands that physician-assisted suicide, suicide, euthanasia, whatever the motivations might be, is a problem within our worldview. Now, I want to stress this for the following reason. It is not enough for rabbis and other Jewish is concerned to say this is usher. We need to be offering alternatives. Because if you just tell people this is usher, and they don't speak the language of usher or mutar, or even religious language, and you don't offer another vision of how to deal with aging and end-of-life care, no one's going to listen to you, including your own people. And so that's why it's super important to understand that we are willing to care greatly, deeply about alleviating pain and suffering, even when we understand that might have some side effects, not our intent, but side effects towards the end of life. I have here from Rabbi Steinberger is an explanation of the dying patient law in Israel, where he talks about, as we all know, about morphine or other types of medicine or pain medications that be given toward the end of life. This is clearly mutter, where the intent, of course, is to alleviate pain and suffering. Intent matters. Right? Now, it even can go so far, since Eliezer made this point, many others as well, but even can go so far as palliative sedation. Palliative sedation is something which is important to know about. When we have a case where a person's alert and there's intractable pain, they're saying, I'm really suffering. Right? So the option of palliative sedation is a way of removing person's alertness with pain medications as they are dying, in the process of dying, or the day, last days or weeks, whoever it might be. This will end up as a result that they're not going to wake up. But you're not killing them. The intent is to alleviate pain. And this can take a day, 2, 3, 4 days, whoever it might be. Someone in my own neighborhood in Modi'in is suffering from cancer. Her husband's a very prominent intensive care unit doctor in Israel. And she was on home hospice at some point. It just became unbearable. And they administered palliative sedation here with home hospice. And the family members are all wondering, why is it taking so long? Right? They're very nervous. It's a day, it's 2 days. And they called up the head of Tzabar, the home hospice. And he explained, it was secular. And he explained to them, we're not doing euthanasia. We're not doing euthanasia. We're alleviating pain. And when she dies, and she'll die, that's from the natural causes of death, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu will decide when that's going to be. It took 3, 4 days. But this is very different than euthanasia, and let's understand why. Why do people want euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide? Why is it so important? Because people want control, which is reasonable, and they don't want to get to the point where they're feeling this pain. And so if as a society we're not offering significant options of palliative care towards the end of life, people are going to say, well, then take away my suffering one way or another, which is why I'm so concerned that as we move forward, right, in societies where euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide becomes an option, are we going to still offer the alternatives as well? Where does this come from? So the Carter case in Canada, which transformed everything in 2015, put a big issue on the rights to liberty and security of the person, which deal with concerns about autonomy and quality of life. An individual's response to grievous and irremediable medical condition is a matter critical to their dignity and autonomy. Now, Carter wasn't the first time this issue came up to the courts. It was already being discussed in other countries as well. And if you look what happened in the United States, this is when they allowed physician-assisted suicide in the late 90s in Washington and Oregon. So some of the gedolei of the philosophers of the time period, right? 6 great philosophers, Ronald Dworkin, Thomas Nagel, Bob Nozick, John Rawls, Judy Thompson, and Thomas Scanlon, wrote a public brief to the Supreme Court, which was also then published in the New York Review of Books. And one of the arguments that they made, and this is they're pushing this in a very strong way, is our Constitution forbids government to impose such convictions on its citizens, meaning this notion of saying that we don't have the right to die is a matter of belief, which is an infringement upon people's liberty. Okay? And they cited Planned Parenthood versus Casey. What was Planned Parenthood versus Casey? The 93-92 Supreme Court case, which affirmed Roe v. Wade. And the logic of said of Roe v. Wade says we have autonomy over our bodies. So if we have autonomy over our bodies in the cases of abortion, we should have autonomy over our bodies in the case of euthanasia. And they continue to go on and make an argument. So listen, we allow people in the United States to withdraw care. If this is the case, why is this so different? And here's a key point which they make about the expressed wish, where they say as follows on the right side. They have no right to compel a doctor to assist them. The right in question, that is only a right to the help of a willing doctor. In other words, what they're saying is live and let live, or live and let die. But the problem is you can't just die on your own. You should have the right to a help of a willing doctor. And the pushback then, by many, here's one from George Fletcher, himself a very prominent legal philosopher, said that you are going to entirely corrupt the entire medical profession. Because you say this is just a matter of a right to the help of a willing doctor. No. That is reforming or conforming or changing entirely what the notion of what it means to be a doctor. And there are many arguments brought here on these, along these lines. I bring here from Leon Kass. Leon Kass, himself actually quite a traditional Jew today, lives in Yerushalayim. By the time he was the head of the President's Council of Medical Bioethics, and he made a big push to argue in saying that what it means to be a doctor is to care for the dying, not to make them dead. And here's sort of how I would like to formulate it. Is the obligation of a doctor to heal or to care? So I had this debate with the former head of the Canadian Medical Association a couple of weeks ago in this open conversation. I said to him, the duty of the doctor is to heal, and you're transforming what it means to be a doctor when you're saying now the duty is to care, and sometimes care means to kill the patient. And he said to me, no, the duty of the doctor is to care. I get it. We should all care. But we allow people to intervene in other people's bodies for a specific reason. Virapo irape. Mikan nitan reshut. We give from here permission to intervene in someone else's body for the sake of healing. We should all care for everyone. But a doctor or other healthcare professionals have an obligation to try to heal. Sometimes we can't always heal, so we alleviate pain as much as possible. It's a total reformation of what it means to be a medical professional. And now we're in the situation where 10,000 people, more in Canada alone. So what do you do when you have a situation which the courts and the government were sensitive to, when people object on a conscientious level to this? So the Canadians here know that effectively in Ontario and other places as well, we have what's known as effective referral. What's effective referral? So we'll see a little bit of a specification here. The physician takes positive action to connect a patient with another physician, healthcare provider, or agency. That means to say, if you say, I want to have no part in this, you can't exactly not have any part in this. So if your patient is asking you for this option, you don't have to provide it, but you have to tell them where to, how to go and get that type of care. Now, if you think about this for a minute, let's say you are an OBGYN and someone once asked you, different state, different country, I'm interested in abortion. You were against abortion in this circumstance. Would you be obligated to tell the person, but here's the phone number to get an abortion, where you can get abortion? So here is what effective referral is mandating, is making sure that people, you don't have to do it, but you have to make sure that other people know exactly where they can get it from. And it specifies, oh, go back. And it specifies this has to be effective. That's the key point here. It's just not working again. Can you do the next slide? Is anyone up there? I can't seem to get it. And one more. One more. Oh, no, back one now. Now it's happened. Okay. Is effective referral a halachic problem? Now, I want to ask this question on a technical level, and then I want to ask this question on a broader level. So this is very interesting. And here, friends, you have to know how to read Hebrew books and English books. What do I mean by that? The world of Jewish medical halacha has Hebrew books, which is where much of them are written in. And then they have English translations. Not every English translation translates every word. And you'll see a good example of this. One day I like to write an article about comparing the Hebrew originals and the English translations of some of these works. So here you have the well-known Sefer by Dr. Abraham, S. Abraham of Nishma Abraham, where he brings down the Psakim of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Eliashiv, if a person is asked to participate in an illicit abortion, that means abortion sometimes is allowed by halacha, of course, but in a case where it's not allowed, should the ultrasound technician or an anesthesiologist have to give up their job even, not to participate? And the physicians that at least were recorded here was the anesthesiologist, who were deemed more directly involved, should not participate, even to the point of giving up a job. Whereas the ultrasound technician, which is a little bit further back in the process, would not have to do that. Okay? Now, what's fascinating is that Dr. Abraham also asked the Tzitzeliezer, Eliezer Waldenberg, on this issue. And Rav Waldenberg said, no, I don't think this is actually a violation of what we know as lifnei iver, right? It would be usher to actually perform the illicit abortion. But even for the anesthesiologist or for the ultrasound technician, for sure, this is not a problem. Why not? Because if they don't get your help, where will they go? To the other doctor. And in general rule we have with lifnei iver, if the prohibited item is accessible on the same side of the river, so to speak, it's not a problem of lifnei iver. And it's particularly in cases where the people don't care about halacha, maybe it's not a problem of misaya. I don't want to get into all the details here. And his argument was this would not be a problem enough, at least, to make you have to quit your job. What about effective referral? What do you think? Now, it's fascinating. When Dr. Abraham had this translated in English, he brings down this psak. And in the footnote in the Hebrew, he says, by the way, I also had a conversation with the Tzitzeliezer about it. See my Hebrew work. Why did he do that? I don't know. I would speculate that he did that because he wanted in English for the policy to be made very strongly that we cannot participate in these things. Not crazy. Although it's unfortunate if you don't know the Hebrew book, right, to know this position. What about effective referral? So Rav Asher Weiss, Shlita, one of the great poskim of Yerushalayim, his brother also lives in Montreal, he's a chassid v'dayan there as well, has written a tshuva, which hasn't been published yet, but may or may not appear on the next screen. Oh, there we go. In which he basically sighs like the Tzitz Eliezer. It says that on a technical level, effective referral does not violate lifnei iver. Why? So he says, first of all, you're not actually doing an action there, right? Not even doing a medical intervention there. And moreover, right, it's on the end of the day, it's toloi bedat acherim. The actual isur is only going to be prohibited at a later point. And he says at the end, I really feel very uncomfortable with this because I do not like the phenomenon of euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide, but it is not a violation of lifnei iver, and I don't want Jewish doctors not being able to practice medicine in Canada. He's very, very clear about that's part of his motivation here. He does not want to be the situation, and even though he sees himself in the fuller tshuva, he says, I see myself very much committed to the Psakim of Shlomo Zalman Orbach in general, but here I'm going to depart from it. So you might say, if that's the case, listen, what's the problem? Because after all, the other people will do it, or you say the goyim will do it, or whatever it might be, but if we can get around not having to violate halacha and still operate in this medical system, what is the problem? Whoop. This is hopping here. The batteries are too good. So I want to show you a couple of arguments. In general, do we have an obligation to help non-Jews keep the Shiva Mitzvos for Noach? Seven Noahide laws? Any Chabadnikim here? Oh, what was the Lubavitcher Rebbe's Zatzal's position? Do we have an obligation to teach non-Jews and try to get them to keep the Shiva Mitzvos for Noach? Yes. But the Rebbe was unique amongst 20th century poskim on this position. And in general, the feeling was that we don't have an obligation to try to get non-Jews keep the seven Noahide laws. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't care. Why should we still care? There are a number of different reasons brought down the Rishonim and the Achronim why we should care. One reason is given the Sefer Hasidim. He says, hey, look at Yonah. Who did Yonah try to get to do tshuva? Non-Jews. The Bible, we care about what's going on in the world. The Rambam discusses this well and says, Shelo yishachet ha'olam. We need mishpatim in the world. The world will get destroyed. The most interesting answer in my mind is in the Maharam Shik, 19th century. Maharam Shik says, as soon as it's going on amongst the broader society, you know who's going to do these Yisurim? Jews. Don't think that we can just say, ah, it's going on in broader society. We can keep this away from ourselves. No, no, no. It's going to impact us as well. And I am telling you, I speak to rabbis in Montreal, I speak to rabbis in Toronto, I speak to rabbis in California and other places. This is impacting our community, including the traditional Jewish community. Now, you might say, wait a minute. Let's think about another parallel, which was abortion in the United States. Friends, did any Orthodox organization in the United States ever oppose Roe v. Wade? Any? What about the Aguda? Did the Aguda oppose Roe v. Wade, abortion rights in the United States? Year after year, case after case, the Aguda always filed briefs on the pro-choice side. Pro-choice side. And their argument was always Roe v. Wade was decided wrongly on bad rationale, but if you ban abortion, you're going to ban abortion in cases when it's halachically mandated, and we need to make sure it stays legal and safe for our community, and internally we can keep it rare. And only recently did this change a little bit, some of the politics in the United States and Dobbs, et cetera, but by and large, and look at there's a quote here from a tradition article from the leaders of the Aguda, who says, yes, it's true, Aguda's advocacy on this abolition of abortion seeks to protect narrow Orthodox Jewish interests. Imagine that! So you could say, well, maybe there should be a parallel here as well when it comes to MAID. After all, like we just want to keep things to make sure we protect our rights. And if it's not impacting our rights, then what's the difference? So first of all, I want to take two arguments. Ironically, the person on the right, certainly when he wrote this in 1974, was a conservative, big C conservative rabbi, Rabbi David Novak. Now, he's also a small C conservative. He also now lives in Toronto and is a member of Orthodox Shul Shari Shemayim. But he wrote in 1974 something, which is quite fascinating, where he talked about, says, when reverence for life is at a low ebb and the clamor for open abortion is just one symptom of the moral climate of our times, Jews who have been tragic victims of the contempt for life should be the last people in the world to support legislation that would give carte blanche and moral sanction to abortion. And then he said something very fascinating. At a time when the hold of Torah is so weak for so many of our people, we should by all means strengthen the only moral code many Jews still recognize, namely the law of the secular state. In other words, what his argument is to say is, if you think that this is going to, right, just not impact us, of course it's going to impact us. It's going to impact the Jews. And you have to ask, do we want to be in a situation where Jewish doctors are obligated to effective referral? The Jewish doctors in this room know this much better than I do. That's an uncomfortable situation. Do we want to be in a society where it could be that part of the default comes and the natural part of the culture has become is, what is the point? Just have euthanasia. Now, I want to bring this home in a very interesting manner. As you know, in Toronto, the building of the Neshama Hospice, they've raised over about $21 million already. I assume it's going to be opening up in the next year or two or three. Now, this is a great idea, hospice in general, all in favor of hospice care. It's a wonderful thing. It's a good, a very positive thing. This is a hospice that is claiming to be the first hospice residence in Canada built on Jewish values for the benefit of all. Will there be MAID and the Neshama Hospice? Well, since the director of the Neshama Hospice is the former director of the Canadian Medical Association who ushered in MAID in the past few years, I think the answer is clearly yes. And so therefore, well, let's bring this home. This is going on in our community. It's part of the culture of the system that we live in. and it's going to impact our healthcare. And here I want to notice our allies might not be our fellow Jews, but the Catholics and other religious groups. So you see here a headline from, three weeks ago, where you had a meeting of Jews and Catholics who met in Yerushalayim to stress the importance of palliative care, of relieving suffering, but to come out against euthanasia. Those are important alliances. And I would only argue, though, that at this moment, the alliance needs to expand not just to the religious, but amongst those who care about human rights, who are worried, as we saw beforehand, about where things are going. So what I want to do with this, the most important thing I want to do with this is raise awareness. This is a situation in Canada. It's spreading. It's going to come to the UK. I think it's coming to France sooner than the UK. It's spreading in various United States. In different legislatures in the United States, there's all sorts of, every year, every other year, there's another proposal go on. And at some point, it's going to pass in those states. It's in California. It's in New Jersey. There's a bill now in Connecticut and many other places. This is going to impact the medical care that the Jewish community receives and the culture in which our doctors operate and function. And it's time to wake up. And to be smart about it, and to recognize that we might have limited political clout and things might be on, the ship might have sailed in certain places, but at least to protect and make sure that the rights that we think we're entitled to as Jews, but not just as Jews, as human beings created in the image of God, are being respected for ourselves and for others. Now, I'm happy to say that last week or two, there's been a little bit of movement again within the Orthodox community to get some energy going on this issue with the COR and others, but it's going to need a lot more than that. And in particular, to think about the impact of effective referral, what it means to be a doctor, and the impact of the culture of euthanasia on what it means to be a patient in Canada. I'd like to end on a happy note, but I won't. Questions? Yeah.
So there are a number of issues which some of them will be discussed later in this conference about end of life and ICU. In, as you mentioned with abortion, there's always a policy that a physician could excuse themselves if they didn't want to disconnect the patient from a ventilator. In 2014 or 2015, one of those 2 years, Breakthrough Respiratory Disease published an ethical article where they said that there's no other doctor readily available within a very short period of time, say 1 or 2 days, I don't remember the exact period, then the doctor is obligated to disconnect the patient, even if they morally object. And there's an Orthodox rabbi that signed on onto that also agreeing with it. We spoke about it subsequently. But the point is that it's signed on and published. And it's very possible that something like this goes through, and then there's a practitioner or a geriatrics or whatever type of doctor out in some area where there's no other doctor for hundreds of miles, which exists many places in the United States and maybe even in Canada. It's
one day
forced to do this also, obligated by the government.
So Dr. Ellen Warner is here as an oncologist, a member of Amitai's medical advisory board. So I invited her to speak about this issue 3 weeks ago at the World Mizrahi Conference. And she brought up just exactly those cases, which are already ongoing, right? You're a doctor, a nurse, anesthesiologist, member IB, short on people, you're going to be called in. It's going to be very uncomfortable to say no. Very uncomfortable to say no. That's going to be hard unless you have a communal backbone backing you up. So yes, right? I think it's very, very possible. Now, again, if there was a case, and this is like we talked about with abortion or even pulling the plug, wherever it might be, where there's some shita, which justifies in a case, that'd be one thing. Much harder to do this here. Much, much harder to do this here. Yeah.
There's a famous quote by Bob Hope in the mid-70s that I just flew from California where they just made homosexuality legal. I figured I'd get out before they made it compulsory.
I have already been told twice in the last few years that because I oppose MAID, that I should get out of medicine. And I don't think they need that. That I should get out of medicine because my values are no longer appropriate and that I'm not providing good care for my patients. I've been told that if I refer to it as doctor-assisted murder, I could have a college complaint placed against me, even though this country still supposedly has a charter of rights that guarantees my freedom of speech. I think the main issue here is not so much that it's become widespread or accepted, but that the zeal of the activists will turn it into an obligatory facet of medicine. And there will be no stopping it because the way the college works, it doesn't care about the Charter of Rights here. We don't have those protections as physicians.
I think your fear is, from the reports I'm getting from many people, and I hope we'll have many conversations about this over the weekend, your fear is well-founded. And it's well-founded because there hasn't been enough people organized with political clout, medical clout, political clout, to push back against it. And particularly in protecting the rights of doctors, the rights of conscience, it's a big deal. It's a really, really a big deal. And so I'm afraid of where it's going. This is why Rabbi Karapkin said to me that people are telling the young people who are thinking about going to medicine, you might want to think twice about it. The consequences of that are unfathomable. So I'm not a scaremonger. I don't like Fox News. I don't talk about death panels or anything like this. This is scary. We should be nervous about it.
Not a question, but I would like to end on a happy note.
Oh,
at the meeting that did happen a couple of weeks ago, which was spearheaded by some of the rabbis from Kor, but also some of the rabbis of the city. And I'd like to encourage anybody who would like to join this committee that their efforts will be really appreciated. But with the conclusions of the meeting were that there is going to be an educational push in terms of what the perhaps Jewish perspective is. And I would like to mention also Dr. Barry Pakas told us as well that in the general medical community, it's not only Jewish doctors, but about 50% of all doctors, as an overall figure, are morally or conscientiously objecting to want to participate in MAIDS. And this is even more shocking, 90% of current medical students do not want to participate in MAIDS either. So that's a bit of a happy note. There is a...
Well, let's hear from him because he's right here. So go ahead.
2021 plus version. But the happy note, though, also is that a huge proportion of medical ethicists, with the exception of who are involved in drafting the current regulations, are also very much opposed to the current version that doesn't require.
So I met at the COR today with the people that are involved, with the others, they got it, to try to help them to facilitate some more rigorous data and rigorous arguments to make a stronger case, because I don't think shul rabbis, I love shul rabbis, are sufficiently equipped to deal with this, which is why we need to bring in some extra reinforcements to help them out on this. But I will tell you, we have to have limited goals because the ship has already sailed. Very, very unlikely of any of this being pulled back, with maybe the exception of effective referral. And that's a scary thought because your healthcare in Canada, which is a national health service, you know, which has it's not like for those of you in America or other places, this is going to impact everyone's healthcare and end of life treatment. So I'm happy to end with your happy note. I'm happy to do that. And, it's Yom Yerushalayim. So let's celebrate that at least. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Yashar Koach, everybody, and for a wonderful evening. The good and the bad, or the good and the, a couple of housekeeping announcements. We'll daven Maariv in like 3 minutes, right in this room. There's supposed to be a mechitza, it's not here yet, whatever it's supposed to be, but I wrote them, please go out in the morning. Tomorrow, Tfilah Chagigit, Yom Yerushalayim, the extended Pesukei Zimra, Halal, with the bracha. That will be 7:15 in the morning for Yom Yerushalayim. Then the caterer asked me to say if anybody didn't eat, or even if you did and you want to eat some more, there's some more food next door a little bit. And I think, is there anything else we have to announce? 7:15 tomorrow for Shachrit. And I think that otherwise, Laila Tov, Ladav and Mariv, and everybody enjoy. If you haven't met yet, everybody, you know, we should do the thing. We'll stop. Everybody talk to the person next to them, introduce yourself, say one interesting fact about your life. The beautiful way to meet people, actually, if you should maybe try. Laser, you have to go that way. And okay, yes, somebody had a comment. Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah. Is there Daf Yomi? Not officially, unless I can ask her. I mean, they're not a shear planned, unless we didn't put it in skin. So.